The location where Jesus chose to ask this question, this crucial question, who do you say I am? The location itself was an important one. It was a place that had a lot of associations and connections with various other beliefs and allegiances. The area was scattered with Syrian temples to the worship of Baal. It's also the area where the River Jordan has its source in the form of a stream that gushes out of the mountainside. And for that reason, of course, it also would have been important for the Jews because of the significance of the Jordan River for them. The same eye of the Jordan River was believed by many to be the birthplace of the Greek god Pan, their god of nature. And not far away was a great temple built in honor of the emperor, the Roman emperor, who was himself, of course, considered something of a god or a demigod, at least by his subjects. And in amongst all of this, Jesus asks that question, who do people say the Son of Man is? He's saying, in effect, what do people say about where do I fit in? And they report on the current theories, rumors going around. Some say John the Baptist or Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the other prophets who has come back to life, and so on. Various theories that were current about Jesus at that time. And that's been true ever since then, hasn't it, really? More books have been written about Jesus, more opinions expressed about him than about any other person in history. But the real issue in the end is not what others think or say about Jesus. The real issue is in the next question that Jesus asks the disciples, who do you say I am? And that question comes to us, doesn't it? Just as much as it did to the first disciples. Who do I say that he is? And it's such a pivotal, vital question, isn't it? I would like to suggest that it might be a question that we'll be asked at heaven's gate one day by Peter or whoever may be on duty at the door on that particular day. On that day, we won't be asked, where did you live? What school did you go to? What job did you do? We won't be asked which church you will go, where you went to. Although having gone to LMC might not be a bad item on your CV. I think we won't even be asked, how often did you go to church? But we may well be asked by Jesus, who do you say I am? Because, of course, our faith is about a person, isn't it? It's not about an institution. It's not about the activities, religious activities that we might perform. It's about Jesus and about who he is to me. It's about the relationship that I have or may not have with him. And of course, we know well Peter's reply to that question by saying, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, which is the same word in the Greek, at least in the Hebrew, the Messiah, Greek, the Christ. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And you and I ultimately need to come to that point, don't we? As Paul says in his letter to the Romans, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That isn't all that being saved is about, but that's where it needs to start, at least, isn't it? To proclaim with our lips, to believe in our heart that he is Lord, that he has been raised from the dead. To say, like Peter, you are the Christ, the Messiah, you are the Lord. You have risen from the dead and you are Lord. What are the implications of saying that? One is self-evident, although maybe not obvious. And that is simply to say that if Jesus is the Messiah, then I'm not the Messiah, you are not the Messiah. No, nobody else is the Messiah. And that may seem even too obvious to question, to mention, but I think it's still necessary to do that because there are people who have what is called a Messiah complex. And such a person feels that they have to take on themselves the role of Messiah, that they have to be able to help everyone and save everything in the world around them. But we don't have to be, and we can't be the Messiah. But we do have to be the person and to do the work for which we have been placed on this earth. Jesus was sent to this earth as Messiah. We have been put on this earth for some other purpose, and we have to fulfill that purpose for which God has put us here. We don't have to be Jesus, but we do need to strive to be the person that Jesus would be if he was you or me. To be the kind of person Jesus would be if he was you or me. In our situation, in our home, in the places that we spend our lives day by day. There to be the person that Jesus would be. In the words of an old song, let the beauty of Jesus be seen in me. All his wondrous compassion and purity. O thou Spirit divine, all my nature refine till the beauty of Jesus be seen in me. And similarly, as a church, we cannot be the Messiah. We cannot solve all the problems of the world, even all the problems of our community. But we can and we must strive to be the church for which God has placed us in this place at this time. It seemed interesting and significant to me that in this gospel reading set for this particular Sunday, there is a reference to building the church just when we are, in a sense, not rebuilding but reopening our church. After Peter's declaration, Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And maybe it's a good time for us to reconsider what does it mean to be that church? What is the meaning of Jesus' words? You are Peter the rock, and on this rock I will build my church. Over the centuries, many have assumed that Jesus was referring to Peter when he spoke of the rock on which he would build the church. Many have understood Jesus to be saying that Peter would be the, as he was, the first head of the disciples, but more than that, he would be considered as the first head of the church, the first pope, as the Catholics would say. Another interpretation of Jesus' statement is that Jesus is saying that he will build his church on the kind of declaration of faith that Peter has made. That Jesus builds his church on the foundation of those who acknowledge him, as Peter did, as Messiah and Lord. And that is certainly true. I'm not sure about the first one. We'll find that out from Peter, I guess, when we meet him at the gate. But certainly it's true, I believe, that it is on that kind of profession of faith that the Lord is able to build his church. And I think that's a timely reminder, isn't it, as we consider the new normal, as is often spoken about, the new normal for the church. Whatever the church looks like going forward, always at the center must be Jesus as Lord and Messiah. Jesus and his kingdom must always be at the heart of our worship and of our lives as individuals and as a church. Shortly we'll sing the song When the Music Fades. I understand it was written in response to a situation in a particular church where I think amongst the leaders it was felt that music had and singing had become too much of an emphasis, too much of a focus in that church, almost to the extent that Christ had almost been eclipsed in some measure. That song says, when the music fades, all is stripped away. And I simply come longing just to bring something that's of worth that will bless your heart. I'll bring you more than a song, for a song in itself is not what you have required. You search much deeper within. You're looking into my heart. I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you. It's all about you, Jesus. Maybe the current regulations against singing, or at least singing out too loudly, can be a bit of a reality check for us. The things we do in worship, whether it is singing or whether it is the preaching or the fellowship, whatever it is, nothing must be allowed to eclipse the one for whom we are here, first and foremost, the one whom we come to worship. Paul, as we heard, says in Romans 12, in the light of all the goodness, all the things that God has done for you, offer yourselves as a living sacrifice, a living act, a living offering of worship. Not just the worship of your lips, but he says the offering of your lives. Present your bodies, your very life as a living sacrifice. All that you are, all that you do. As we read the book of Revelation and in other places, we are reminded, aren't we, that the central activity of heaven is worship. And if that is the case, then surely it needs to be a central focus of the church here on earth. And I think that's one of the reasons that it is good to be together as we are again today. Because worship at its best, not exclusively, but at its best, is worship together as God's people. As together we are able to lift our worship, as together we are able to raise our hearts and our voices. And yes, singing and music are a wonderful vehicle to express our worship, but it mustn't be allowed to become the focus. The singing, the music is a means to an end, not an end in itself. And so the ongoing questions about traditional or contemporary music, of hymns or songs or what instruments we use, is really of secondary importance. The primary question should be, how can we best express our worship? How can we express our worship most adequately, most fully? In some cases, it may be in this song or that hymn or this style or that style or this instrument or that instrument or no music, maybe just in the silence. We tend to speak, don't we, of a church service. But I think more correctly, it's a church service of worship. This is the service, the best service that we can offer, as Paul says. The best offering we can give is the offering of ourselves. offering of our worship. Together here on a Sunday, and individually as we live our lives, day by day. On that, I believe Jesus will be able to build his church. Amen.